Feels so artificial somehow. Okay. It's, if I can remember the date, that would be good. It's May 8th.
Is it 8th May, or 7th?
May 7th.
I think so, it's 7th.
Yes, because you came in on the 6th, right? I can erase all this part. It's May 7th, 2019, and I'm Sandra Hale interviewing Nadia Lali about the Association for Middle East Women's Studies and anything else that she might want to say to the microphone. One of the reasons why I wanted to interview you is because you're one of our few members who actually comes from abroad, and that, you know, that must have had some meaning to you to make that decision to come to the AMUS meetings. So I'm wondering what encouraged you, and what were you thinking? Mm-hmm. And
right. So I started coming to Mesa when I was a PhD student. I'm not entirely sure when the first time was, but I think it was whenever it was in Chicago, it was 95 or 96. And at the time, I mean, my PhD thesis was on the Egyptian women's movement. So I was very excited to come to a conference where many of the scholars whose work I had read or was reading as a graduate student, both while I was an MA student at AUC, but then also as a PhD student at SOAS, were actually present. And I'm not sure whether I went to the AMUS meeting that very first time, but if it was not the first time, it was the second time, and I was curious, Association of Middle East Women's Studies. I didn't know anything about the organization, really. I mean, I'd come, you know, from the UK via Egypt, via Germany, and, you know, it wasn't obvious that I... and so whether it was in Chicago that first time or the second time, I went to the meeting, and then I was just, you know, very happy to see in... person. And you know, it was intimidating. I mean, when you as a graduate student go to these big conferences in the beginning, I mean, you know, I didn't really have a network yet, and I felt to be made welcome. I felt that, you know, people were talking to me, and I know that you were one of the first people I met actually at the meeting.
Really?
Yes. And you were talking to me, and then there were a few other people who were also talking to me, and it just provided me with a space. And I don't really know why I decided to basically come back every year to Mesa. I mean, there's a strong correlation for me between Mesa and AMUS. I think for me, what was attractive about that space is, I should say that I had done my undergraduate degree in Tucson, Arizona, where of course Mesa has its headquarters. At the time, I wasn't involved in Mesa at all. But for me, I made that connection between Tucson, the place where I did my undergraduate degree, and actually Sarah Palmer. Yes. Sarah Palmer was my classmate. We had Arabic together, and we were friends together as undergraduate students. So she was a link for me to Mesa. And then there was AMUS, and through my increasing interest in feminist scholarship academically, but also involvement in feminist activism politically, sort of came together. And for me, more and more, I mean, Mesa equated AMUS. I mean, that initially it was sort of the other way around. I was interested in Mesa as a space where I could meet people that I knew from Tucson, people that I knew from Cairo. And, you know, it was a great place to sort of just reconnect with the various friends of previous lives, mm-hmm. and then I slowly got to know about Amuse, and I don't really remember exactly the meetings, but I just remember that increasingly I would find myself drawn to the meetings and the discussions, and I got more involved. I mean, wasn't just sitting there. And I personally found it a welcoming place for myself. But
I meant to use Mesa, not Amuse, so you can see how intertwined they are for me as well. I should have said, when was your interest in Mesa and so on. And also, I was struck when I interviewed Azza Basaruddin. She said that she got similar to what you just said, but she got very excited seeing in the flesh those people that she'd been reading for some time, and that was really part of the excitement. I'm curious about what the personal experience was, like you said, people were very welcoming and so on. But
yeah, not everyone, but there were enough people who were.
Okay. All right, I stand corrected.
Yeah.
How do you see Amuse now? I mean, is there a difference in how you saw it initially and how you see it now?
Well, I mean, I guess for me the biggest difference is that my positionality has changed. So from being a graduate student in awe of the founding members and the sort of people who had been coming regularly, I've become one of the people that, graduate students come to, and I'm thinking, oh my God. Although I have to say, I still feel the same. I still feel on one level, I still get surprised when I get that reaction. But no, I mean, obviously I've been on the board, I've been president of Amuse, so my relationship to the organization has changed. But I also, while I feel that I myself had a positive experience in terms of that this became a space that allowed me to feel at home at Mesa, and also created, I mean, my move to the US now, I think, is facilitated by the fact that I feel that I already have a network of scholars through my involvement with Amuse. I mean, scholars and friends. Mm-hmm. I'm not starting from scratch. And although I think Amuse has been trying to sort of reach out, and of course there are people like Hoda Al-Sada, who's based in Egypt, Nicola, myself, previously based in the UK, but generally speaking, it's still very much an organization that focused on people who are based in North America. Going back to your question, I now feel that I'm not so sure that graduate students always feel so welcome. I think that, although I think as an organization we have tried all kinds of things to reach out, as in, for instance, have a presence at WOCMES, where you have many European scholars, but also more people from the Middle East, and use our sort of individual connections to the Middle East. It still seems to somehow, there is a perception, rightly or wrongly, that it is an organization of people who know each other, and I fear that maybe sort of especially younger generation of scholars, even within the US, but certainly also people who are based in Europe and the Middle East, might not know how to get involved. I'm not even sure if they want to be involved. So I don't know whether Amuse has that appeal beyond the US network. So I think that there are things that, we have to sort of think about and work on. I don't have a solution. It's a bit tricky.
Well, I wonder if I've been, you know, all of us have been thinking a bit about that and why we're not able to, don't seem able to interest grad students. I don't have any solutions for it either, except that many of them cannot afford to come to the meetings.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Aza, even when she was secretary, she had to stop going because she just couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
And for a while, I found it to be financially very draining.
Yes.
Or very draining is an exaggeration, but, you know, it is a factor. It's that travel. So for a while, we tried to get some funding, you know, for grad students, but then how do you select the people that you're going to bring? So that became somewhat of a problem.
Sure.
But I don't, I don't know how they see AMUs in the world. That is, what are competing organizations for them? And I'm not sure. But yes, I think that we need to do something about it.
Well, I mean, I know sort of in the context of, say, the UK, where you have something called the REF, the Research Exercise Framework, that very much puts pressure on not just young academics, academics in general, to publish in certain journals and be part of disciplinary networks as part of this continuous assessment of research output and quality of research. I think lots of young academics in a context where it's very difficult, of course, to get jobs with the limited resources would choose to go to a conference or be affiliated with an organization that's sort of directly linked to their discipline. So, you know, to the international, like a politics or an anthropology association. So I think, and then, I think that's one important aspect. I mean, the reason I've had several of my graduate students get involved in MESA and AMUs, because of me, you know, I encouraged them. I'm not particularly sure they would have known about it. You know, I also don't know how much people, especially graduate students outside of the US, know about AMUs.
I wonder also in terms of grad students choosing to be a part of AMUs, I wonder if our professionalism of the last several years where we've, you know, we have a journal now, we're taking ourselves more seriously in a whole lot of ways, that might scare off grad students in a sense. We were a little ragtag group of people for a while, and we just, it seemed to be a nice thing to get together, you know, and we weren't doing serious programs, if I remember correctly. And then we started, you know, doing panels and that sort of thing. But I don't know, maybe the professionalization should have attracted students.
I don't think it's a professionalization, because I think that that's what many grad students are seeking. I mean, there's a small group maybe who likes to look for kind of more radical and formal place. But I think precisely because of the pressures of the job market, people are looking for professionalized spaces. And I suspect that, I mean, GEMUS clearly has taken off, I mean, for a long time. I mean, GEMUS is doing extremely well now for years and years. And I suspect that lots of people don't make the association between GEMUS and AMUs. I don't think that many people know about the history of GEMUS and what it stands for and how it grew out and, you know, what organization is behind it. I think that has something to do with it,
Well, I remember Amani saying that GEMUS is killing AMUs, and I remember I I think I was co-editor at that time, and I was so angry. And I did talk to her about it, but she meant financially that A-Muse was draining J-Muse. But I think it was probably more than that. And maybe in J-Muse we need to stress A-Muse more than we do. You know, it's not enough for people to read it in the masthead. This is the organ of... I don't know how, you know, how one would do that, but it's something to think about. Well, how has it served you professionally?
Well, it has provided me with a network of scholars and friends who are interested in similar issues, and I've been involved in either co-organizing panels or conferences, publications. I mean, I feel that I've been lucky and blessed that much of what I've done in terms of publications has been a result of people approaching me and asking me to do things. I mean, I've also done things because I wanted to do them, but it has been, I felt that it has provided me with a space to work in, and also I should say that in the context of promotion and now getting the job at Brown, there were some people that I knew would support me. I mean, they already knew about my work, and yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly who's written letters, but I'm sure that people who have sort of supported me either with, you know, promotion, getting tenure, getting the job, or people, because everyone is sort of, the senior scholars are part of the network.
Yeah. Well, I realized that I didn't ask you your field or where you're teaching, or that's the problem, I guess, with interviewing someone you know so well. Well, you're an anthropologist in the Middle East. So talk a little bit about the trajectory of your career.
Yeah, so I was trained as an anthropologist, but always with a focus on women and gender studies. And I should say that I feel much more at home within gender studies than anthropology. I mean, anthropology is, I use anthropological methods. I'm informed by that, and I'm also informed by the kind of ethics and reflexivity research, and maybe also inspired by some of the creativity around writing that I think anthropology has kind of pushed in terms of the different disciplines. But my work has been very interdisciplinary, drawing on history, politics, sociology, cultural studies. So I ended up in Cairo in order to study Arabic, and while I was in Cairo I got involved in a secular Marxist feminist organization, and this was at a time when there was lots of scholarship on women and Islam and sort of challenging the singularity of the Muslim woman, but secularism was very much homogenized and sidelined. So I became interested in the question of what secularism means in the context of the Egyptian women's movement, which grew out of my experience being involved in this Marxist feminist organization in Cairo. And that was my PhD, which I did at SOAS, working with Denise Candiotti. During that time, while I was doing my PhD, it was in the mid-90s, it was at the height of the sanctions period on Iraq. And so I started to get involved in anti-sanctions activism and trying to document the impact of economic sanctions on women and gender in Iraq. I should say that I'm half Iraqi, I have family there, so it was personal, it was political. And so then I also started to work on Iraq academically. And with a sort of small interlude, which was a job, My first job was actually to look comparatively at Bosnian and Eritrean refugees and the question in how far can refugees contribute to reconstruction without actually returning home. Anyway, I then for over 15 years focused on Iraq and the impact of dictatorship, sanctions, invasion, occupation on women and gender in Iraq, and also looked at political mobilization in Iraq outside. And at some point, I think it was 2014, with the emergence of ISIS, and I had written a paper about gender-based violence in Iraq, and I felt very depressed about the situation in Iraq, and I was looking for something more positive and hopeful. And at the same time, I was also intrigued by the Kurdish women's movement linked to the PKK, and there was a peace process going on in Turkey. And so I started to look at the intersections of feminist and peace activism in the context of the Turkish-Kurdish conflict and started to do fieldwork in Turkey. Well, that didn't last very long and the situation got very quickly very bad. So now I find myself increasingly being interested in comparative work, looking comparatively at particularly gendered mobilization against authoritarianism, Egypt, Turkey, Iraq, and also I'm interested in Lebanon, the Kurdish movement. Mm-hmm. Yes, and I just recently moved from SOAS, where I had been teaching for 11 years. I was chairing the Center for Gender Studies, to Brown University. I'm now have a joint appointment between the Anthropology Department and the Watson Institute for Public International Affairs.
Well, there's a question that we've been asking everyone, which I've shown to you already. This, who were the people most instrumental in the various attempts to develop AMUs and JMUs? And what I want to do is to go, you can combine it with what you see as some of the problems that either you saw historically or you're seeing now.
Well, so I wasn't involved in the creation of AMUs. I mean, that was sort of before my time. I guess for me, there are a number of key people who seem to have driven different aspects of AMUs and JMUs. I mean, shortly after I got involved, I know that you and Nancy were involved in JMUs, so that was, you know, very instrumental. And we've been together serving on the publication committee and following the history of the journal, which I see as an important aspect of AMUs. Of course, Suat Joseph has played a very important role and has, in the various meetings, always is playing a key role in terms of pushing certain initiatives and suggesting ideas. I have very much appreciated Huda Esada's contribution because I think it's really important to have someone so committed and invested in AMUs who is actually based in the region, aside from the fact that Huda is a great scholar and a great activist. And of course, I think from the very beginning, I saw Amani Jamal very much involved, I think initially for many years as the treasurer, and then sort of moving on to become, you know, president. I mean, there are lots of people that I think have played an important role. Now the current treasurer, Louise, she's very committed and invested.
By the way, I was Amani took one of my classes as an undergraduate at UCLA.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
So I was very pleased to see her become active.
Yes.
AMUs.
No, that's great.
You were talking about, you just mentioned Louise, yes.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think there's, you know, I don't want to miss anyone out, but there's sort of a core group of people who have been involved for a long time or ever since I'm aware of AMUs and are very sort of invested and committed. And I'm sure, you know, there are other people that I didn't mention. I think it's great, but I think there's also a problem in that I think, although, you know, we had a discussion about it, you know, that we don't want to appear like a clique to outsiders, but I think there is that perception, and I think there is, I think more needs to be done to kind of break that perception and challenge that perception and not come across as, you know, this group of friends or colleagues who've been around. Of course, Miriam Cook is one important, other very important member, you know, have known each other for a long time and were involved in establishing Amuse or have joined later. And so that's a tricky bit, I think. And I think it might mean sort of step for some people, you know, maybe sort of slowly to step back and make space for. Of course, it's tricky because you need to have people who want to move in into positions, and it's how to create that wish for younger generations of scholars, activists to move into those positions, especially given that, you know, everyone is busy, of course, with getting jobs or getting tenure. And
I think some of us of an older generation have this notion, we don't say it out loud, but have this notion that if we drop away, the organization might just fall apart.
Yeah, it might be true as well. there is a point to it, no? There are kind of individuals who get involved for a short period of time, maybe serve as a elected member of the board, maybe serve as a president, editorial board member or so. But how do you translate there are people on the Amuse list, although that in and of itself is also a question, is the Amuse list really representative of the possible constituency? You know, we had lots of discussions, only people who pay up, should there be part of it, or is it important to keep that sort of wider communication going? Mm-hmm. I think it is a real concern, you know, if certain people wouldn't do it anymore. I mean, I don't want to call them the old guard, but yeah. Would AMU still continue? I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure that there is this, that there is enough human resources and interest and commitment by younger generations. And I think that's a big question. How can we create that? How can we make Amuse attractive?
I've had two experiences along the lines of, well, related to the theme we were just talking about. If the old guard steps away, you know, what might happen to the organization? Well, it might change, of course. But I was just telling you earlier today that I'd been coordinator of California Scholars for Academic Freedom for 11 years. And somewhere inside of me, I must have thought that if I drop away, the organization might collapse. And in fact, it was just the opposite. I mean, some of it came from the fact that we had our first face-to-face meeting, and that of the board, and that always sort of gets people energized and so on. So that happened as well. But the organization is doing quite well. There was another organization, Socialist Feminist Network, that I was a part of for 10 years, that I kept it alive. I mean, I thought that it was just going to be horrible if it collapsed. And we had fewer and fewer members, not for reasons very different from AMUs, any dropping away of attendance, that is. But I just had it in my head that I just had to keep it going, and until someone said to me, look, every organization has, you know, a natural lifespan, and, you know, that people will form something else somewhere else. So I did learn that, and I think that's what I applied to the... But this isn't about me, this is about you, so I have to... But I always enjoy engaging with you, and so I'm entering into this interview. I'm sorry that the phone is ringing, but it happens. And now my voice. Probably won't hear it. Well, there's a last question, which, you know, is so typical, it's almost a cliche. What didn't I ask that you thought I would, or is there something that you want to say, one or the other? And
well, I mean, maybe what I haven't said is that I did very much enjoy actually being involved in AMUSE. Also, I mean, I said that I enjoyed it as a network and as a sort of safe space at Mesa, but I did get involved at the level of I became a board member elected. What is it? Is it board member elected board member? The
yes.
And then I became president as well. And I think I was the first president that came from not from North America.
Yeah.
So that was, I wore that with a badge of honor.
Yes,
I was very proud of that.
And then Huda came along.
Yes. So I, you know, I learned a lot from the experience. Let's put it this way. I'm not sure that I learned that much from it. I mean, I had sort of learned from observing and engaging with everyone. But I enjoyed it, and I did feel at the time that, because while I was president of AMUSE, I organized an AMUSE meeting at WOCMAS that was in Barcelona.
I
was amazed by there was so much interest.
Yeah.
There were so many people. It was exciting, you know. I feel I failed in sort of following up on that excitement, you know.
Well, we all should.
Yes. But so I think that that's something, I think sort of moving forward, I think we should sort of tap into sort of reaching out beyond the usual network. And going, I think, in the context of Mesa, I think it's very important that we, you know, go to panels or seek out, whether it's graduate students or, you know, other academics who do relevant work, who are not plugged into AMUSE, and actively invite them in.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important to personalize that invitation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe a few people
will
come.
Yeah. I don't remember. I think there was a meeting at WOCMAS this year.
But not
a program.
Yeah.
I wasn't there.
Yeah,
so,
me neither.
So I don't know if any excitement was...
Yeah.
Stirred up or whatever. What did I not ask you that you thought I would?
No, I think pretty much the other thing I want to say, I also noticed, of course, that depending on where Mesa is and what we've organized, we have had successful or not so successful social events. I think some of the kind of more stiff dinners which were expensive and in kind of grim rooms were not so good. I like the sort of more creative ones. I mean, I liked what happened at San Antonio this year, for example, where we had a dinner outside of the hotel and it was nice.
Mm-hmm.
But also obviously some of the ones with program worked well, and you know that they kind of created a buzz, and you know people wanted to be there. So yes, I think that's also important to that social event is also what creates a community, I think.
But we probably need to, as you've said, that we probably need to shape them differently and carefully. And having them outside the hotel is probably a good idea. Mm. Hard to arrange.
Yes, that's difficult to
and,
arrange.
And that's another thing. You know, yeah. We're not a very well-endowed
yes.
organization. We're always scraping around. Mm. But we started giving awards, and I don't know really how important these have been, and I'll give you an example in a minute, but, you know, awards for whatever, lifetime.
Book awards, a lifetime book awards, achievement.
Yeah, the
yes.
book awards, I think, are
yes,
quite
I
successful.
Think, yes, yes.
And students do participate
yeah.
in the, you know, article.
Yes.
And we
yeah.
could... We could do more of that, expand it more, and so on. I don't think that I remember that I was honored one year, and somebody that I did know, she actually had applied to UCLA for the PhD program and decided to go to Stanford. Anyway, in the midst of all of this, somebody talking about me and so on, she came up sort of during an intermission, or maybe it was right after, and she said something like, "Is someone getting an award or something?" And I thought, well, we didn't really make ourselves very clear, did we?
Well, I think that must have been the odd person out.
Yeah,
I think we made ourselves pretty clear. That is funny, though.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Yeah, well, thank you
yeah,
very much.
Yeah, thank
I
you.
Will enjoy... if I don't accidentally erase this, then we'll have to do a telephone
yes,
interview.
Okay, that's fine.
But I'll enjoy reading this on our website, and I'm sure many people will. So thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, we didn't even say where we are. We're in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.